Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, April 30th, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as today we discuss the new book, 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of the American Constitutional Law, put out by Oxford University Press. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups, General Counsel here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed. We're very pleased to welcome three guests to our telephone conference call today. We'll hear from each of them in turn, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. We're very pleased to welcome, as I said, the Honorable Jeffrey S. Sutton, the U.S. Court of Appeals of the Sixth Circuit. He's the author of the book, again titled 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law. We're joined as well by the Honorable William H. Pryor, Jr. He's the U.S. Court of Appeals judge from the 11th Circuit. And Professor Randy E. Barnett. He's the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Legal Theory at the Georgetown University Law Center. We'll hear from them in that order, beginning with Judge Sutton. With that, Judge Sutton, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to do this. Most books on constitutional law tend to focus on the U.S. Supreme Court and the U.S. Constitution. The other thing I'd say about those books is the narrative is often similar. It's states as villains, federal government as heroes, U.S. Supreme Court as heroes, and Jim Crow, Brown versus Board of Education are pretty good examples of that approach. The point of the book is not to contradict that narrative, but to supplement it by talking about some times in American history when the state courts and state constitutions have had a leading role in a positive way in developing American constitutional law. The book grew out of my own experience, which initially had nothing to do with state constitutional law. I didn't study it at Ohio State. The course wasn't offered there. In fact, it's taught at about 20 out of 200 law schools in the country. So I knew very little about it early on in my practice. But in the mid-1990s, I became the state solicitor of Ohio and suddenly found myself facing quite a few lawsuits that arose under the state constitution, school funding lawsuits, voucher lawsuits, tort reform. I tell my students at Harvard and Ohio State that I could teach a full semester class based solely on cases I lost under the state constitution of Ohio. So that experience and the experience of defending some federalism cases in the U.S. Supreme Court with my friend Judge Pryor led me to really wonder why litigants and state courts aren't thinking a little more seriously about state constitutional law as a way to protect our bedrock liberty and property guarantees. One reason for this is I think most Americans are fairly ignorant about the existence of these state constitutions. There was a poll in the 1980s that said only 50% of Americans knew their state even had its own state constitution. That's quite ironic when you think about American history, because the greatest era of state constitution writing in this country and indeed in the world happens before the fabled summer of 1787. Between 1776, actually before July 4, 1776, and the summer of 1787, the states, of course, were busy drafting their own constitutions. And it turns out that all of the individual rights guarantees in the first eight provisions of the Bill of Rights, some in the original Constitution, 14th Amendment, all come from state constitutions. Really, the only patentable idea in the 1789 Constitution is the splitting of the atom of sovereignty, in Justice Kennedy's words, federalism. So it seems strange to me that we care so much about judicially enforceable rights in this country and yet have not been paying that much attention to the role of state constitutions in state courts in construing those guarantees, particularly since they all originated in state constitutions. So the one key question that the book takes on throughout is, why and when might a state court construe, say, due process, equal protection, unreasonable searches and seizures differently from how the U.S. Supreme Court has construed similar or even identical language in the U.S. Constitution? One reason a state court might chart its own path is not all constitutions are alike. Some of the guarantees have different language from the U.S. Constitution, and of course many states have their own histories which might affect the interpretation of a guarantee. A good example might be free exercise of religion. If you're a state Supreme Court in Utah, Maryland, or Rhode Island, you might think quite differently about that guarantee given the history of that state than another state court might think about it, and that difference should be respected in our country. Another reason why a state court might chart its own path when it comes to a bedrock guarantee is that they might simply disagree with the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of similar, even identical language, which of course they're entitled to do in construing their own constitution, in which they're, you know, they're the final arbiters of the meaning of that guarantee. So you might have a U.S. Supreme Court decision that, for the sake of argument, is living constitutionalist or pragmatist, and the state Supreme Court might decide to take a different approach, an originalist historical approach to that guarantee, and they're free to do so. Vice versa, you could have an originalist U.S. Supreme Court decision, and a state court is free to have a living constitutionalist interpretation. The stories after Kelo and Smith are very good examples of that, where many state courts did not follow Kelo or Smith, and many state legislatures rejected them as well. Another explanation why a state court might take its own approach to a guarantee is the fact that some guarantees are written in very general language, unreasonable searches and seizures, equal protection. It's not obvious why the phrase unreasonable should have just one interpretation for an entire country, and state courts are free to take account of their own experiences, their own policy concerns, their own precedents in deciding, for example, that unreasonable search and seizure means something slightly different in that particular state. Equal protection is another good example. I think by one professor's count, there are now 7 tiers of review when it comes to equal protection clause jurisprudence. I could imagine a state court saying that sounds like a failed experiment, and we're going to try a different approach to equal protection and not go down the federal road. Just as, you know, Justice Brandeis said, we have laboratories of experimentation in this country. And when he said that, he was referring to policymaking, and policymaking primarily by the legislatures. If it's appropriate to have laboratories of policymaking experimentation, I'm not sure why it's not an equally good idea to have laboratories of interpretation in law. It seems very healthy as a way of developing law, and it's actually what we do in other areas of law. Torts, contract, property, usually developed from the ground up, usually with the states as the first responders. The states are the innovators in deciding what to do with new issues, new policy problems. And sometimes we nationalize a view, and sometimes we leave it with 2 or 3 competing views throughout the country. If that method is good for the common law, I wonder why it's not equally promising when it comes to construing constitutional law, and for the U.S. Supreme Court to perhaps be a little more patient in watching these experiments of interpretation unfold in the state courts. This approach, like all federalism principles, has the happy and unhappy incident of being entirely neutral. Justice Scalia, in his last majority opinion for the court in Kansas versus Carr, made this exact point, saying that the states can experiment all they want with their own state constitutions, and often do in the wake of restrictive U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And of course, Justice Brennan wrote a landmark article in 1977 to the same effect, encouraging state courts to innovate under their own constitutions. So the focus of the book is 4 chapters on 4 particular constitutional law issues. One's on school funding, one's on the exclusionary rule, one's on compelled speech, the flag salute Barnett case, and one's on eugenics. I'll talk a little bit about the eugenics chapter just to try to illustrate more concretely some of the messages of the book, and then turn it over to Judge Pryor. There's a part of the eugenics story that most everybody knows or remembers most of, and that's the U.S. Supreme Court side of it, the Buck v. Bell side of it. That's the 1927 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, authored by Justice Holmes, joined by Chief Justice Taft, Justice Brandeis, an 8-1 decision. Only Justice Butler dissented, although he didn't write a dissent explaining his views. And that's, of course, has the infamous line, three generations of imbeciles are enough, rejecting Kerry Buck's claim that the 14th Amendment prohibited the state from involuntarily sterilizing her. The part of the story that I certainly didn't know a few years ago, and I think most people do not know, is that before 1927, there were 8 lower court cases addressing the exact same issue, most in the civil setting, a couple in the criminal law setting. 6 of those cases arose in state courts, and 7 of the cases came out the right way by the verdict of history. Now, there's a particularly good New Jersey Supreme Court decision protecting Alice Smith from an effort to sterilize her, just like Kerry Buck. What really surprised me is that one, Buck versus Bell, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, doesn't mention any of these cases, even though some of them arose under federal law, some were under state law. The other obvious point is by the verdict of history, this is a case or a situation in which the state courts were the heroes. I think most people would agree the U.S. Supreme Court played the part of the villain in that particular story. I think the thing that concerned me the most about the story, and the one that remains puzzling to me to this day, is what happened after 1927 and after the Holmes Buck versus Bell decision. We know before 1927 that the lower courts, 7 of the 8 of them, had no trouble vindicating state and federal rights in this area. After 1927, they no longer had that option when it came to the federal constitution, but they retained that option under their own state constitutions. And yet no state court follows the path that they'd started before 1927. They all backed down, and in fact, quite to the contrary, another dozen states passed eugenics laws in the years after 1927. So there's something wrong, it seems to me, with a system in which we tell the state courts they have independent authority to construe their own state constitutions, to give them a second shot at protecting individual liberty. We have a story where they did just that before 1927, and suddenly when they hear the U.S. Supreme Court speak in Buck versus Bell, they suddenly forget they have that authority. So the point of the story is to make us question why that is, and the other stories are variations on that theme. So why don't I let Judge Pryor offer a few comments before we start to have question and answer.
Be happy to. This was a fun book to read, and it reminded me of one of the parts of the Federalist Papers that's one of my favorites, Federalist 51, where James Madison argued that in the compound Republic of America, the Constitution would provide a double security for liberty by dividing power between two distinct governments and then subdividing the powers of those distinct and separate governments. The two governments would control each other at the same time that each would be controlled by itself. If there's a modern day evangelist for Madison's double security, it would probably have to be my friend Jeff Sutton. He's been doing that ever since he started his career as a solicitor for Ohio and later as a scholar of state constitutional law based on that earlier experience. And in fact, I have a story to tell about how we first came to know each other. We appeared together on a panel for the Federalist Society. I don't know how many years ago it's been. It's probably been 20 years ago, where Jeff was really making the kind of pitch that he makes in this book, and we immediately got into an argument about it. and we've been debating and discussing and fighting about it, I guess, ever since. And part of his pitch is really the focus of one of the chapters of this book, and it's the chapter that focuses on litigation about public school funding. Of course, in a very important decision, the Supreme Court of the United States in the 1970s in the Rodriguez, the San Antonio School District case, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal constitution would not provide a basis for challenging funding disparities in public schools in the state of Texas. And Jeff made the argument that that was a good thing for federalism because then it allowed, it freed the states really to operate in this field. I viewed that as a call for, I guess, a kind of judicial activism I had been working against, and I now understand that Jeff had been working against too in his experience as the Solicitor of Ohio. But in my previous life as the Attorney General of Alabama, we had some of that, what is sometimes called adequacy or equity in funding for public schools, some litigation about that in Alabama, and eventually succeeded in convincing the state Supreme Court that it was not really the business of the state judiciary. It was really, it inevitably involved political questions that were best resolved by the state Board of Education and by the state legislature. And so our argument really was about whether encouraging state litigation about that kind of subject was a good thing or a bad thing. But I want to take a little issue with something that that Jeff mentioned a moment ago when he said that this book really does not contradict the conventional narrative, that is, that the states are the bad guys and the federal officials are the good guys, and that the Supreme Court of the United States, above all, provides the safeguard for our liberty. I think in many ways this book does refute that conventional narrative, and all the better. I think the chapter on the eugenics movement is really a great example. And of course, some of this has been, some of this territory has been plowed before. Adam Liptak's book, Imbeciles, and earlier scholarship about Buck versus Bell. But what I did not know before I read this book was the role that state courts had played before the decision in Buck versus Bell, and then really the tragic outcome of states retreating from the field after the Supreme Court decided Buck versus Bell. There's really kind of a similar story in the chapter about the Pledge of Allegiance, and of course the dramatic reversal of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court really got it wrong in 1940 in Minersville School District versus Gobitis, when it allowed public schools to compel students to give a stiff-arm salute to the American flag contrary to the students' religious convictions. These students were Jehovah's Witnesses, of course. And then 3 years later, we all know the Supreme Court did an about-face in the Barnett decision when it ruled that compelled patriotic act violated the free speech clause of the First Amendment. What I didn't know before I read this book was the role that that state courts played in the interim, particularly the Supreme Courts of Kansas and Washington, which laid the groundwork really for the dramatic reversal by the Supreme Court when it ruled that their state constitutions, when those state courts ruled that their state constitutions prohibited these violations of religious conscience. I think importantly, the book is more than about federalism. Federalism is certainly a focus. It's more than about what state courts and state lawyers should do in the arguments that they should make in defending individual liberty and the kind of experimentation that should take place in our federalist system. But it's also very much, I think, a study in the role that state legislatures can productively play and that state executives can productively play. One of the interesting things about the chapter about the eugenics movement is the role that state governors played in resisting eugenics legislation. Another interesting aspect too is the really the refutation of the conventional narrative about southern states as the worst actors. The one area, the one region of the country, this is important to me as an Alabamian, the one region of the country least likely to enact eugenics legislation and to actually conduct involuntary sterilizations was the Deep South, and probably in large part to the role that religion has historically played in the South. But there's an argument here, I think, about really both sides of the double security that Madison talked about, not just the role that can be played in the development of constitutional law in the courts, whether it's federal and state, or, but also the role that the other branches, the political branches, play in defending our liberty. I guess the biggest question I have when I read this book, though, is I do wonder whether our current division of red and blue states makes the development of state constitutional law as a first line of defense less likely. You know, in my own home state of Alabama, the state constitution protects an individual right to bear arms with no mention of a militia, and it offers multiple and robust protections for religious liberty. But state law, as would be true, I would guess, in, say, Utah or Texas, really imposes few burdens on those freedoms. Conversely, in blue states like Washington and California, state constitutions expressly protect a right favored by many political liberals, privacy, that would not otherwise be threatened by those state governments. So I do wonder whether there really are incentives for lawyers and courts to engage in differences in constitutional interpretation, particularly in the way when you consider, as Judge Sutton mentioned a moment ago, the challenge that was laid down, you know, 40 years ago by William Brennan in his article in the Harvard Law Review. This is not the first call for this kind of work, but it really went nowhere after Justice Brennan made that call 40 years ago. And I do wonder whether the divide of red and blue states is part of the reason. And then I also do wonder how the differences in methodology, judicial methodology, would play out, and how likely it would be for lawyers to make the kinds of arguments that lead for better results for their clients if they expect the judges in their state, for example, to follow an originalist interpretation. Would that really give them a better result for their clients, which is what the lawyers are going to care about, than say they would get from a living constitutionalist interpretation under the federal constitution. But the great thing about this book is it gives everyone a lot of food for thought about just how the development of American constitutional law can take place, given how it has taken place in some earlier periods of American history.
Thank you, Judge Pryor. With that, why don't we turn to Professor Randy Barnett?
Thanks, Dean, for having me here today, and thanks to Jeff for writing this book. I know what I know how he feels about teaching constitutional law using cases that you've lost. I know that feeling very well. I want to agree. I guess let me lead with the most important thing. It was probably the most important thing to the audience of listeners, and the most important thing to Jeff Sutton and Judge Sutton, and that is that everybody should right now, while they're on this call, go to Amazon and pre-order this book. Everybody should buy this book. You should also read it, but I think Jeff Sutton will agree that the first priority should be buying it. because it's a book that you're going to want to. This is a book you're going to want to have read. I agree with Judge Pryor that this book does in fact undermine the narrative of the Supreme Court as the white hat hero, a narrative that has been undermined by other works. In fact, I think I undermine that narrative in my own constitutional law casebook and in my class. So that's a useful service. But what's really new, again, I agree, what's really new is the emphasis that that Jeff places on state Supreme Court, state decisions, state appellate court decisions that were actually much better than the Supreme Court, and how they've led the way. They led the way in some cases, or they provided resistance in other cases. That's a very important lesson that this, a gap that this book fills. Maybe the most important contribution that it makes in this regard is that it told me something I didn't know about West Virginia versus Barnett, and that is the court misspelled the name Barnett and added an E to the name Barnett when it should have been Barnett with no E, like my name is spelled. And maybe I think this is the most important fact that I learned. I'm not just kidding. It's not the most important fact, but I like knowing it. I'm certainly going to mention it in class. So let me move on from praise to some more critical commentary about the book. It's primarily going to concern chapter five, the issues that are raised by chapter five, the compelled sterilization chapter, which I think is just outstanding. And I learned a tremendous amount. I learned everything that Judge Pryor says he learned. I learned as well. By reading that chapter. But that chapter illustrates a problem that Judge Sutton has in applying some conventional distinctions to his own fact-finding. And the two distinctions that he has a problem, that give him a problem, are the first of all, the distinction between substantive and procedural due process, the very familiar one. And the second one is the distinction between judicial activism and judicial restraint. So let me just use the balance of my remarks to explain why I think the facts that he reports serve to undermine the utility of both of these distinctions, at least as they're currently conceived by most people in the profession, most Federal Society members. So first, let me talk about substantive and procedural due process. A distinction which Judge Sutton does, I believe, accept, particularly near the end of Chapter 5 and does not challenge, is as a meaningful distinction. My critique is that it's not a very helpful distinction. What he notes and what he reports are the extensive number of state courts that resisted compelled sterilization using the due process of law standards, and to some degree, the equal protection standards, but primarily the due process of law standards that they found in their own state constitutions. In order to do that, now, of course, all these laws were passed according to the procedures that existed in the legislatures, so that they had the process of lawmaking. There was due process of lawmaking adhered to by all of these statutes. Some of the statutes may have had some procedural problems with how people were adjudicated as qualifying for involuntary sterilization, and later on, some cases dealt with that aspect. But mostly what these cases that invalidated the compelled sterilization laws were doing were examining the substance of the law, compelled sterilization, and saying that that substance of the law violated the due process clause. That would seem like substantive due process if you want to stick with that terminology. I reject that terminology. So here is the way I would look at it, and I think these cases are wonderful examples of this. And in fact, I'm going to add some of them to an article that we have that Evan Burnick and I have forthcoming in the William and Mary Law Review on the due process of law, the original meaning of the due process of law. So let me just say a little bit about what that is and why these cases support our interpretation, our reading. The due process of law is, in fact, we believe, a procedural guarantee. It's a guarantee that there should be a judicial process, the right kind of judicial process, before any person can be deprived of their life, liberty, or property. So in that sense, we agree. It's procedural. It requires a process, and that process requires something be done by the judiciary, something that legislature alone can't do it. You have to have a judicial determination. But that judicial determination includes whether the person has been deprived of life, liberty, and property according to the due process of law. That is, it must be a valid law that deprives someone of life, liberty, and property or property. A mere act of the legislation, for I cannot call it a law, to use John Marshall's phraseology, that is not properly, that is not constitutional, for example, would not be valid, and therefore someone would not justly be deprived of life, liberty, and property underneath it, under the due process of law. Now, we're accustomed to accepting this when we think about, let's say, a First Amendment challenge. It would also violate the due process of law for somebody to be deprived of life, liberty, or property by a law that invades their right of freedom of speech. We understand this as well with a Commerce Clause challenge. It would be a violation. A person would be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law if the Congress, for example, exceeded Commerce Clause authority. All of these challenges are not only substantive challenges based on the Commerce Clause and the First Amendment, but they're also due process clause challenges. Although the due process clause drops out, the way it does also drop out when we talk about incorporating the Bill of Rights to the states, it's really done via the due process clause, and then the due process clause kind of drops out. So all of this is substantive. All of this requires you to look and see if a law substantively is constitutional. But wait, there's more. Also, traditionally and historically, especially after the passage of the 14th Amendment, the due process of law and the due process of law historically back to the Magna Carta was a barrier on what you might call arbitrary laws. Laws that were arbitrary insofar as they deprived some people of liberty that they didn't deprive other similarly situated people. We would call those laws discriminatory or arbitrary because they were irrational insofar as they adopted means that weren't sufficiently related to the ends that we might suspect that other motives were at stake, and that the assertion, for example, of a police power was pretextual and not actually in good faith. This is exactly what the lower courts did in these that Judge Sutton reports in this with the compelled sterilization case. They examined these laws critically, the substance of the laws critically, to see if they were arbitrary because they involve, let's say, class legislation, which is one form of arbitrary law, or because they didn't seem to address the problem that they ostensibly were aimed at. I won't go any further into that. Read the book. You'll see lots of quotes from these cases that put this forward. So this is a version of what you might call substantive due process, but modern substantive due process is really different. Modern substantive due process is about the identification of a fundamental right and then giving that fundamental right super-duper scrutiny of some kind, and thereby making legislation with respect to that fundamental right very difficult. That's not what I'm calling due process of law, which involves a substantive element, but that's modern substantive due process doctrine. All right, so there I think this chapter supports the reading of this due process of law clause, or at least state court decisions did. Now, the second and last...
Hello?
Professor Barnett, we can't hear you any longer. I don't know if you've accidentally muted your phone, if you need to come off mute.
Well, why don't I start responding, and then if he comes back, we'll go from there. Although...
That sounds great. Go ahead, Judge Sutton. And just let me interject here in case folks have lost track here. The title of the book, 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law. We're speaking with Professor Randy Barnett, who we've lost momentarily, and Judges Bill Pryor and Jeff Sutton, the author of the book. With that, Judge Sutton, please go right ahead.
Yeah, sure. I'll go in reverse order, just a few points before we open up for broader questions. Randy's article is quite good. If I had read the article before writing the book, I would have modified how I said a few things. The book tries to be agnostic about methods of interpretation, agnostic about how exactly we characterize due process. But another way to think about
he
the book, which,
home.
We lost you for a moment, Randy.
I'm sorry very much. Where did you lose me? What was I last talking about?
Why don't I respond, Randy, to what you were saying, and then you can add what you were saying. But this, I think, will help focus the point.
Okay.
I was saying that I found the article you wrote really helpful, and I hope everybody reads it. And I think had I read the article before writing the book, I would have modified a couple things because there's some really good insights, and I actually think the article ultimately supports what the book's trying to do. You know, if one is skeptical of modern due process doctrine, as some people are, and I would say you're one of the leading advocates for that, others say that we ought to use more natural law in construing rights guarantees, including the 14th Amendment. I would say those are, you know, incredibly worthwhile projects. As a federal court of appeals judge, I love getting arguments from advocates and amici about different ways to think about solving a problem. But I think that kind of a project is going to be a lot harder to win initially at the U.S. Supreme Court. One way to get some momentum on a project of that sort is to convince state courts, construing their own state constitutions with their own histories, to start to look a little more carefully at these issues, look a little more carefully at due process doctrine, and under their own constitutions start to develop some of these ideas. That way they can spread to other states if they have the support. And I think you're much more likely to nationalize a perspective like that after one has convinced some state courts to do the same things. That leads to the second point, which is, I guess, it's not so much as a response to Bill, but one way of thinking about his point of, does this really work given our red state, blue state world? Well, one of the best examples of a case that at least one of the concurring opinions uses natural law in a very significant way to the state constitution is, I think it's called PATEC, and it's an eyebrow-threading licensing regulation. Of course, comes from Texas, a red state. Then Justice Ouellette, now Judge Ouellette's concurring opinion is, you know, really quite consistent, I think, with many things Randy would advocate and many proponents of natural law would advocate, and anyone who cares about history would advocate. So that's an example where you can get innovation, we'll call it, in a conservative way, even in a conservative state. Kelo is another example of that. After Kelo, all of the states, red and blue alike, whether through state courts or state laws. It's true after Smith, a good deal of the response was done through many state RFRAs, but why would I care and why should anyone else care where one's liberty comes from as long as it's protected? And it seems to me that confirms Bill's point that sometimes we need to think about the role of legislatures as well as courts in thinking about this. My last example would be administrative deference, delegation. This is not really a red-blue state issue. You'd be really surprised to see all the so-called conservative states that allow all kinds of delegations and deference even greater than Chevron. So there's really quite a bit of room out there for thinking about these. And, of course, criminal law issues, exclusionary rule story arises in all states. There's no state that's not enforcing its criminal laws. You know, the last point I would respond to is Bill's very good question. I think it was Bill's, maybe Randy mentioned as well, is why didn't more happen after Justice Brennan's landmark 1977 article? I don't think he was an ideal messenger for this because he wasn't subtle about what he was saying, which was this should be a ratchet for liberal causes. And all of his examples in his article were what one might call classically liberal rights guarantees. He certainly wasn't mentioning property and contract guarantees, or for that matter, separation of powers in his article. But his message was frankly worse. His message was, side with me in disputes at the U.S. Supreme Court, follow my dissents at the U.S. Supreme Court under the U.S. Constitution, no less, not urging a ground-up inquiry as to each state constitution and why this guarantee or that guarantee might mean something different. I mean, this will never get anywhere if all we're doing is redebating federal debates about the federal constitution through the prism of U.S. Supreme Court justices. This has to be a localized, local language, local history, local culture set of debates, and I think only then will it be taken more seriously.
This is Dean Reuter. Let me see if we have Professor Randy Barnett if he wants to respond at this point or augment? I don't think so. So let's open the floor now to questions.
There's one thing I would add, though. This is Bill Pryor. And that is, you know, part of the story for those who are skeptical of substantive review of legislation in the name of due process of law, part of the Buck versus Bell story, which is really quite interesting, is how Justice Holmes, who was who really had a reputation of not evaluating the merits or the substance of legislation, but deferring to the political process, deferring to the majority as reflected in enacted legislation. In Buck v. Bell, did something very different. And as he confided in a friend afterwards, he was able to say something that he really believed about the substance of the eugenics legislation, which was that he agreed with it. And part of the problem with the Buck v. Bell story is that, and in looking at it, he actually endorsed the substance of the legislation. And that, too, is part of the Buck v. Bell story, and it's part of what we have to be concerned about when we empower judges to look at the substance of the legislation, insofar as they're not measuring the substance against guarantees in a written constitution.
Hi, this is Randy. Oh, go ahead, Randy.
I was muted. My mic was muted a minute ago. I just want to agree with Jeff. I do think his chapter supports the reading of the due process clause that we propose. And I did before I got disconnected or I cut out. I was actually going to raise the judicial activism point that Bill just mentioned. I think that Jeff is a bit strained in trying to argue why that's activist. In fact, although Holmes did actively seem to endorse the legislation, what he did was defer to the states, which is what ordinarily we think of as a restraint, an exercise of judicial restraint. So I just think the activism restraint distinction is not helpful, and this chapter shows why it's not helpful. What you really want is what Ed Whalen now has been calling correct decisions. He says, it's activism if it's an incorrect decision. It's restraint if it's a correct decision. That's fine. It's not what activism used to mean. But what we need is constitutionally correct decisions, and we need to attack or criticize constitutionally incorrect decisions. And just saying you've invalidated a popularly enacted law does not tell us whether that was a correct decision or not. That was my second comment, and now I will desist.
Very good. This is Dean Reuter again. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see who weighs in with a question, I will make a comment, and that is to associate myself with the comments of Professor Barnett. That is that this is an important book. It's for sale now, and advanced copies are available. The title, again, is 51 Imperfect Solutions. I found it to be a great mix of observation and argument, lots of research, lots of historical research and factual backgrounds on several key cases, a lot new to me. We've touched a lot on the eugenics chapter. There's a chapter that you mentioned on the evidentiary rule. A lot of research went into that as well. And one of the things you mentioned in that chapter, Judge Sutton, is that your impression or conclusion that a national rule might not be as robust as individual state rules. That is, in order to get a national rule, you might have to lower your sights a little bit. Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, no, I think one way to think about it is if you're nationalizing something for 320 million people, there's a risk that you might define the right less broadly because of the number of jurisdictions affected. That might even be more true with remedy. I think particularly with the school funding story, had Rodriguez come out the other way at 5-4 upholding the school funding disparities in Texas, had it come out 5-4 the other way, and it had been time for the Supreme Court to start telling school districts how to equalize the funding between districts, you have to wonder whether their remedial power would have been diluted given the scope of their jurisdiction. And that's why the provocative question that comes out of that story is, did the Rodriguez plaintiffs win by losing? Obviously, those plaintiffs didn't win. But when it comes to the cause of the litigation, it's not obvious. The remedies that were sought, and they've mentioned in some of the footnotes in the opinion, were actually achieved in most states through legislation and a few state court decisions not too long after Rodriguez. So that is one risk. The other thing about the eugenics story, which, it's there are 60,000 involuntary sterilizations in this country over 75 years, which is, of course, quite dispiriting. In Nazi Germany, it's 400,000 over 11 years, and you have to ask yourself why. And federalism, separation of powers, has to be one of the reasons. They didn't have state courts and state constitutions limiting the national government. In 1924, in this country, a bill was proposed in Congress to nationalize eugenics, and it wasn't passed. I'd like to think a court would say that is not the regulation of interstate commerce, and I suspect that that's one reason it wasn't passed. But it's a good example of how separation of powers is indeed a liberty protection.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. But for now, let's check in with our first caller.
Hi, it's Anthony Sanders at the Institute for Justice. Judge Sutton, sounds like a fascinating book. I'm looking forward to reading it. I wondered if you could comment briefly on the process of how states create these constitutions and maybe some reflections on how that – it seems like that process has is not as active as it has been in our history. You mentioned that before the Constitution itself was signed, most states created their own constitutions. There's been other periods in our history where there's been a lot of constitutional drafting and redrafting around the Civil War, the Civil Rights era also. There's also been times when, funnily enough, there wasn't a lot. During the Great Depression, actually, there were almost no new state constitutions. You'd think that would have been a time where there would have been. And we now are actually in a very constitution drought era. The last new state constitution was Rhode Island's in the mid-80s. And wonder if you comment on why we have less of that activity now. Is it because we're focused on particular amendments and people in states don't think they need a whole new constitution? Is it something to do with politics, something to do with the courts? Why is it at times we write a lot of new language and at times we fall back on other mechanisms of political and judicial change?
Yeah, there's a couple points, and they kind of cut in opposite ways. I think the states have had over 300 constitutional conventions. You're right to note that they stopped having them, really stopped seeing them that often in about the 70s. That's particularly unusual given that a third of the states require a statewide vote every 20 years. This is the Jeffersonian idea, but every 20 years the people are supposed to be given an opportunity for a new constitutional convention. And so even though those votes are still being held in a third of the states, we're just not having them. I suppose there's a risk of Pandora's box. If you have a convention, everything is on the table. I suspect some people would say this has to do with a lot of voters being single-issue voters and a concern that that could warp a convention. But the reality is you're having fewer of them. Now, the thing that cuts the other way is that I would still say we're having quite a few constitutional amendments. In fact, that's one of the criticisms of state constitutional law and of state constitutions, is that most of them can be amended by 51% vote. Now, there's some procedural rules and hurdles before you get that vote in most states. About a third of the states have direct democracy initiatives, see California. And people have not been afraid to use those, that they appeal to single-issue voters. Some folks are critical of them. Personally, I do think one way you might think about constitutional amendment is that this might be the greatest effect in the U.S. Constitution, that it takes three-quarters of the states and is therefore so difficult to amend, whereas at the state level, one might argue that it's a little too easy to amend. And that seems to show up in these single-issue amendments. But as you point out correctly, it's quite interesting that we just are not getting constitutional conventions to speak of in the last 40, 50 years, whereas they used to happen pretty regularly. And I must say, many of the state constitutions, they look like state codes, and they could really use some cleaning up, which a convention would be really useful for doing. But, you know, each state gets its own choice. That's what it means to allow a state to both be the final interpreters of it and the final creators of it. And you're right to observe something's going on, and the only thing I can think of is the single-issue voter phenomenon.
Yeah, this is Bill Pryor. I'd like to add something to that. You know, I live in Alabama. Alabama has the distinction of having the longest constitution in the world. The constitution in Alabama was adopted in 1901 in what can only be viewed as a reprehensible constitutional convention that had its purpose, the establishment of white supremacy following Reconstruction and the disenfranchisement of not just black voters, but poor voters generally. And so there has frequently been an effort to reform the Constitution of Alabama to call for a constitutional convention. Now, as Judge Sutton just mentioned, it's easy to amend a lot of state constitutions, and that's certainly true in Alabama, where we've amended it several hundred times. And I think that's part of the answer for why the public's been far less willing to have a constitutional convention. And it's also true that many of the more pernicious aspects of the Alabama Constitution have been invalidated as unconstitutional under the federal constitution. And in my own experience as previously as a state attorney general, the thing I would tell constitutional reformers in my home state was you've got to really make a case to the people of your state about how a new constitution, a cleaned up constitution, really is going to make a difference in their lives every day. Many of the reformers in Alabama have touted the idea of local governments having more zoning and taxing power than the state constitution would otherwise allow. And that hasn't been an argument that has really any marketability with the voters of my state. So I think a lot of what Judge Sutton says is right about how easy it is to amend state constitutions, and I think you have to look at just what is a new state constitutional convention really going to allow for the people.
This is Dean Reuter again. We've got two questions pending, so let's quickly turn to our next caller and see if we get to these final two questions before we run out of time. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS. And I'm interested, and with Hyperloop and a number of companies that are trying to build roads in competition with the federal transportation monopoly and enforce the post-roads restriction, is there any set of state governments that would be interested in using the state courts and state legislatures to enforce both the Commerce Clause and the post-roads restriction?
Well, this is Judge Sutton. I'll start first, but with a serious qualification. Judge Pryor and I both have to be pretty careful about commenting on potential litigation. And so the one thing I would just say, I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but the one message in the book that has a serious caveat is this. The message is that when it comes to state and local laws in this country, most of them are vulnerable to attack under the U.S. and state constitution. The one exception is federal legislation or even a federal regulation, which can only be challenged under the federal constitution due to the supremacy clause. So the book is really primarily about state and local laws would be the only point I think I could make without getting too close to comments about potential lawsuits.
I think that's fair enough. This is Gene Reuter. And by the way, Judge Sutton, I thought that was one of the very interesting questions you raised early in the book, is the failure of advocates to raise not just the federal question, which always gets raised, but the state questions, which sometimes go unargued or unasserted in litigation. I just thought it was an interesting question, almost rises to the level of legal malpractice in some cases. But,
well, I mean, I'd be curious, Randy Barnett's response to why so few law schools teach state con law, even if they don't offer the course. It sounds like your book deals with state con law issues in talking about constitutional law, but it really seems to be undertaught, and I'm curious if you think there's a reason for that.
I'm not sure I know the answer. My casebook doesn't deal with state constitutional law. The part that my casebook does is debunk the Supreme Court as hero myth, that part of your book. I suspect, of course, national law schools tend to avoid local things generally. So the question really would be why more local law schools don't do it. And then I suspect that it might just be because they tend to emulate the national law schools, for one thing, and also that they need to have people on the faculty other than adjuncts. You rightly point out in your book, this is largely taught by adjuncts. They need to have people on the faculty who are prepared to devote part of their career to this. And there's very few incentives, academic incentives, to do scholarship on a state, because that scholarship won't get attention outside that state. So you'd be really restricting your profile as an academic if that was your area of expertise.
Yeah.
Well, Judge, I don't know if this is right or wrong, but this is Dean Reuter again. As I read through the book, my answer to that was that I think we deal with litigants, advocates, who are trying to make a national rule. They either belong with an organization or they want to make a, not necessarily a name for themselves, I'm not that cynical, but they'd rather have a national rule than one state rule in many cases. That doesn't explain why they argue the national rule to the exclusion of the state rule, which it might be available. But
that's what I've been wondering about. This is Bill Pryor, and that the red and blue state divide, I think, might be part of the explanation for that. As you would expect, at least some of the lawyers to be competent practitioners. It's certainly my experience that most are, and I think many of them have to ask themselves, given the particular state that they're working in, whether making that state constitutional argument is likely to give them a better result for their client. That's a hard question. It's a hard thing to really know what the right answer to it is. But you would expect at least some lawyers, just as a matter of economic behavior, the incentives are there for them to make what could be a winning argument for their client. The other problem is that a lot of the threats to their clients come from federal legislation, and making a state constitutional argument in that context, of course, is unhelpful.
We've got a minute left. Let's see if we can get to this final question before we adjourn the call. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Peggy Little with the New Civil Liberties Alliance. You had mentioned earlier in the discussion some things about deference, and there is an initiative in Florida. There's a proposal to eliminate default deference to Florida administrative agencies' interpretations of statutes that is pending, and I wonder if you might comment on the issue of deference and that approach to reaching perhaps a different outcome than what the current law provides for.
So I don't know anything about the Florida proposal, but what I do know a little bit about, and this really is one of the key themes of the book, is the domination of federal law whenever we talk about law at all. that's true of constitutional law. And, you know, it's just so surprising that we teach survey courses about torts, contracts, and property, but not survey courses about state constitutional law, or that we don't weave it into a course on federal constitutional law and make it American constitutional law. But the key point is that the power of the U.S. Supreme Court, the prestige of the court and of Congress and those doctrines really tends to dominate the discussion. So that's why what seems quite surprising is you have so many state courts that reflexively assume the U.S. Supreme Court's non-delegation, or I'll call it delegation doctrine, is the right one for them, or that Chevron or our deference are the right ones for them. And again, I think it's just because the language of debate has been dominated so much by federal decisions. You know, I'm happy to have people reading my federal decisions, but I'm just not sure I know why they deserve any deference in trying to figure out what state separation of powers means. That's for each state, and there's an awful lot to think about when it comes to the appropriate thing to do there. We're having, by the way, a civil war reenactment, which is that explosion. I guess we are talking about states, aren't we? It's just a problem that you see throughout this area, that everyone starts their arguments with the federal law, and presumptively people assume the federal law is correct. And that's just not always true. I would think a sister state's view would be as relevant, maybe more relevant, than a federal court's view when it comes to something like administrative deference.
Well, we are out of time. I do want to give Judge Sutton a minute or two to wrap up and express any final thought he has before we adjourn. Just one final note that we're talking about 51 imperfect solutions available now for pre-order on Amazon. Judge Sutton, a final thought?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the title gives away the final thought, which is, you know, with some areas of law, particularly constitutional law, we're stuck debating between imperfect choices. It's very difficult to say that there's one and only one way to do something. And when that's happily the case, we adopt that correct view. But when we have constitutional law problems where it's very difficult to say there's only one approach, it is very strange to me that we are insisting on this one-stop shopping and adopting one imperfect approach for the entire country rather than allowing different regions to try different imperfect approaches and either showing some patience and eventually nationalizing one view, or deciding that it's quite appropriate with this range of options to allow the state courts to remain largely in charge of it until a problem emerges. And, you know, that's really what I want people thinking about. It's a book of ideas, and I hope it's thinking about American constitutional law in a slightly different way from how we classically think about it. Thank you, Dean, for hosting this.
Thank you. I want to thank all our experts, Professor Barnett, Judge William Pryor, Judge Sutton, author of 51 Imperfect Solutions. I have read the advanced reading copy that was provided to me by the publisher, but I took Professor Barnett's advice during this call. I've pre-ordered my copy from Amazon. I encourage others to do the same. I also want to thank the audience, of course, for dialing in today and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to check your emails and our website for the next scheduled Teleform conference call. It happens to be later today, 2 p.m. Eastern time at this same number. We'll be talking about the recently decided Jesner versus Arab Bank case, actually decided by the Supreme Court last week. But until that next Teleform call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.